welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley reporting from Washington, D.C. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 18th of September, 2015. Now, the big news, the big diplomatic news, and the big news in general is it looks like the United States is moving in a at least semi-rational direction. What we're referring to here, reports are that a United States-Russian Federation bilateral military commission, or at least military talks, are in the works, is in the works for Syria. And this has been the subject of multiple phone calls between Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, one of our favorites on this program, and this guy we have, John Forbes Kerry. Note the Forbes, of course, of Skull and Bones and all the rest. But at this point, you can see how bad things have gotten here. The Skull and Bones guy is actually the lesser evil in the U.S. government. If it's a choice now between Kerry and, say, Samantha Power, or worst of all, the ISIS czar, John Allen, then Kerry seems to be representing at least a semi-rational point of view. And indeed, this may be the personal efforts expended by Lavrov to try to create some sort of common field of reality between himself and Kerry. In other words, it may be a triumph of Lavrov's intelligence over the terrible heritage that that Kerry brings to the table. Anyway, we may soon have this going on. That is an amazing development. Now, obviously, what do we have to do? This also gets us then into the question in Europe, right? We're getting all sorts of people in Europe coming forward with this idea that they want to break with the U.S. line, which is correctly seen as bankrupt and destructive. And it is especially dramatic right now because of this refugee crisis, right? The wave of a million refugees or more already on the roads, moving on the oceans, many getting killed, but pressing forward. And then the United Nations report that says there's going to be another 1 million refugees coming towards Europe. Now, as of about last weekend, Saturday to Sunday, after the broadcast, we began seeing that in particular the German government, and this starts with the German Defense Minister Ursula von der Leyen in the CDU, and then Frank-Walter Steinmeier, the foreign minister from the SPD, and then, of course, Madame Merkel herself of the CDU. And the common line was, we are turning to Russia. If we're going to stop this civil war in Syria, which is obviously the main thing producing the refugees, right? It's ISIS and the civil war. It's Nusra, Al-Qaeda, terrorists, killers, butchers, right? Who wouldn't run? Anybody in his right mind is going to run, and devil take the hindmost. So if you want to stop that, the U.S. effort over 1 year, thanks to the sabotage of ISIS czar John Allen, who is responsible for this wrecking operation, we know what it is. It's the policy of phony war. Phony war means you pretend to be at war with ISIS, and frankly, you're not. This is what the French generals did and the British generals did with Hitler in the winter there of 1939 to 1940. It was a big nothing. It was a phony war. And, of course, the phony war is a continuation, with other means, of an overall policy of the appeasement of terrorism. That means having the means, having the ability to wipe out large terrorist concentrations and not doing it. That's what we heard from Lavrov over the past week. Lavrov pointed out in a speech, I believe, last Sunday night on the Sunday Times television program. This is not the British newspaper Sunday Times, but the Sunday Times television program. So maybe it's something like one of these blab shows here in the U.S. on Sundays. We had Lavrov coming out saying that the American command knows the location of large concentrations of ISIS butchers and refuses to attack them, refuses to bomb them. And one gets the idea, also prevents others from doing so, prevents others from taking on these groups of terrorists. So that's the phony war, and that's the appeasement, and that's Allen up and down. And, of course, Samantha Power. It is, as usual, the unholy alliance between the neocons and, of course, Allen, representing the Petraeus Allen neocon generals clique, power-hungry, insubordinate, restless, contemptuous of Obama, lots of racism thrown in there. We heard it all, right? We heard it from General McChrystal, right, how they would make dirty jokes about the president and the vice president. And yeah, okay, but unfortunately, it's not just the locker room where we hear this stuff. They bring it into the policy arena, and that we cannot and will not allow. These generals, we ought to have some equivalent of Limoges, right, to Limoges, a failed and defeated general. We have plenty. There should be some town where you send them and they get to give courses about what they did wrong, and certainly not get rich in Wall Street like our dear friend Petraeus. So it's all going on. It's moving towards a denouement. Now, let me, before we go any further, let me point this out. Russian President Vladimir Putin will be in New York City, we believe, on the 27th. Of September. That's in just, it's about 9 days from when we're recording, and it's going to be 8 days from the first time you're able to hear this. So we got about a week to get ready. I think it is incumbent on the American people, or better yet, incumbent on the organic intellectuals of this American people. Somebody has to speak for them. This government we have does not speak for the American people, still less does the opposition. The opposition is even worse, this Republican fascist clown show that we've seen. We need to provide a worthy and decent welcome for a benefactor and friend of the United States, and that's Putin. In that great tradition that goes back to Tsar Alexander II and the Russian fleets coming to New York Harbor in September of 1861, and then in San Francisco in October of 1861. We have got to show that the American people are not represented by their lunatic elites who are bankrupt, desperate, flailing, and very specifically, the foreign policy elite has gone bonkers. There's this Washington groupthink. They have a psychotic narrative. They say, well, at the beginning in Syria, there were these nice, peaceful demonstrators, but then evil Assad came along and started shooting. This is absolutely delusional. It is nonsense. There never was a peaceful phase in Syria. The shooting began back in the 1980s. These butchers got a bunch of military cadets in an auditorium for their graduation, locked the doors, and killed every one of them. And that was in the early 1980s, and it never stopped. So enough with this crazy narrative. More details on the welcoming of President Putin in just a minute. And here we are back with our second segment of World Crisis Radio. It's Friday the 18th of September. Let me recommend that you pay attention in these tempestuous times to Tarpley.net. Tarpley.net, it is rocketing up in popularity. We've gained about 130,000 places on the worldwide list, according to Alexa. This is undoubtedly due to the new institution of the daily briefing. So now we have something every day, new stuff every day on Tarpley.net. And thanks to all of the listeners, in the United States, but we'd like to thank Austria. We'd like to thank Great Britain, Canada, other places that have been so kind as to take some interest here in my work. And now's the time for the big geopolitical and world historical harvest time. A lot of this effort can now be turned into actual changes in the course of world history and institutional changes that will last. So the lunatic narrative is there was a peaceful phase. There never was. Those guys were the Muslim Brotherhood. They were killers from the very beginning. But then Assad spoiled everything when he started shooting. Now, remember, as people in Homs told me, people who had been dodging bullets with their children fired by these lunatics, bearded lunatics firing from rooftops, those guys were foreigners. They were brought in from everywhere. A large group was brought in from Libya. Those were not even necessarily Libyans. In other words, the CIA secret army that was based in Benghazi against Gaddafi in the year 2011 was shipped from Libya to Turkey. We know it. That's what poor Ambassador Stevens was doing when he got killed. He was meeting with a Turkish official, his last official act before the assault on this Benghazi diplomatic facility began. And they were coming from all sorts of places, from Chechnya, from Saudi Arabia, from above all Darna in Libya, but from Morocco to Indonesia and from Chechnya to Somalia. Every unemployed killer could get bankrolled by the Saudis, and that's what they did. And the Turks made it possible. They allowed that border to be open, and they still do. And everything, all of this idiotic debate in Washington this week ignores the fact the simple thing to do is cut the enemy supply line, close the Turkish-Syrian border. And if they won't close it on the Turkish side, then you help the Kurds to close it on the Syrian side. And that will be the beginning of the end of the vaunted caliphate. But that's exactly what Allen and these characters do not want. They want to use Daesh, ISIL, ISIS, Islamic State, caliphate, whatever you want to call it. They want to use that against Iran. They want to use that against Russia in Chechnya and places like this, in the Caucasus, Transcaucasus, and so forth, right? In Dagestan, all these areas. So they're doing that. Let's get back to Putin. Putin is coming to the United Nations on September 27th, we believe, according to The Hill, reliable congressional watchers, but you know, politics in general here in D.C. Putin is likely to address the United Nations General Assembly on the 27th of September. Now, let's see what he might be doing. Thanks to Thierry Meyssan, the world has gotten, and we have been pleased to add our helping hand to Meyssan and the Voltaire Network. We just had the conference of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. The American media, I've never told you what that is, right? CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, forget it. They have never told you what the Collective Security Treaty Organization is. Well, we have the Organization of American States for Latin America. We have the African Union for Africa. We have the European Union for Europe. We have NATO for the North Atlantic, or better yet, not even NATO. We have the Helsinki Accords, the OSCE. That's a better way to put it. We've got ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and so forth. Organization of American States, I think I said it. But now we have a CSTO, Collective Security Treaty Organization. This is successor states primarily of the former Soviet Union. And they had a summit, their Security Council of that regional organization, which are explicitly provided for in the UN Charter. Russia, Belarus, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan are now offering and urging the United Nations Security Council to accept their offer of deploying peacemaking and peacekeeping forces to Syria. And this comes in the light of 1 year of failure by the U.S., who could have clobbered ISIS, but didn't because of the wrecker Allen and his network, right? That's the ones who cook the intelligence. The reason they cook the intelligence is to hide what they're doing. American people probably not too happy to be so soft on ISIS. Well, you have to hide that. You hide it behind a bunch of rhetoric, and that is what has gone on. Therefore, Putin is coming with a mandate from the Collective Security Treaty Organization, and he's coming to the United Nations. Now, he's going to make a speech to the United Nations General Assembly, and we have a couple of reports on what this is going to be. A highly reliable Middle East source tells us the following. Putin will most likely be in New York on September 27th through September 30th or thereabouts. On one of these days, I think the 27th, he is reportedly planning to deliver an address which will condemn the unilateral economic sanctions by the United States and the European Union as measures which violate international law and violate the United Nations Charter. Two, Putin will call for a worldwide military coalition against ISIS, and it means a serious coalition, a fighting coalition, to shut them down, to wipe them out. Yes, it's unfortunate. It's like saying, you know, Hitler had been built up by the appeasers in Britain, France. Fine. But once he's standing fully armed in front of you and coming at you, you got to defend yourself. And that's what it is. A worldwide military coalition against ISIS. And he will talk about the Donbass, right? The Donetsk People's Republic, which I had the honor to visit, and the Lugansk People's Republic, and also about Syria. On September 30th, we are told, since Russia is the rotating chair of the United Nations Security Council, Putin will be he'll come to the session himself, act as chairman, and will announce the commitment of the Collective Security Treaty Organization against ISIS with or without the United States, right? Because whatever the U.S. has done, it has not really been approved. Putin is going to say the CSTO and Russia can do the same thing. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So Putin is coming to town, and friends of this broadcast and other groups, I'm sure, will be a part of it. We want to have a worthy and respectful welcome for someone who must be considered a benefactor of the American people. Why so? Well, you may remember 2 years ago, we were on our way to general war in the Middle East over this fake chemical weapons fraud provocation, which since, for the Republicans, if you watch their debate, that Ghouta chemical weapons thing has entered into their lunatic version of recent history. It's a complete fraud. It was obviously done as a Turkish-Saudi co-production. What we've learned, we always knew it was the Saudis. We knew it was not Assad, thanks to Seymour Hersh. Two articles by Seymour Hersh, if you haven't gotten up to date on this. Seymour Hersh wrote two in the London Review of Books. No American-controlled rag would take it. In the ones that he usually writes for, I guess the New Yorker, whatever his traditional dwelling place is, couldn't do it, had to go to the London Review of Books. And we find out that Obama knew, he not only knew that it had not been Syria, he knew that it could not have been Syria based on the monitoring of Assad's office that the NSA was doing at this point. So we were about to have a war, and finally Kerry shot his mouth off about, well, if they gave up all their chemical weapons, that would do it. And then it happened, and Lavrov and Putin picked that up. So did you want another Iraq war? Isn't it worth thanking somebody who made it possible to avoid that? It's true. Our own leaders are so incompetent. We have to appeal to foreign leaders to get any hearing at all. So I say let's do it. It's going to be a historical occasion. Here we go. Putin will be the session of the United Nations Security Council on September 30th, and will say the Collective Security Treaty Organization, including Russia, will now deploy against ISIS with the attempt of destroying them and we wish to cooperate, but if necessary, we will go it alone, just like you have so many times with your neocon unilateralist idiots. How about this? According to a highly reliable Eastern European source, Putin's first speech to the United Nations General Assembly in 10 years will be a landmark presentation rivaling in importance his legendary address to the Munich Security Conference, that is to say the Verkunde Gesellschaft Conference in Munich, Germany, February 2007. They're still talking about that one. That's when we had warmonger McCain in the front row practically bursting a blood vessel with apoplexy about the obvious simple things that Putin had to say about the non-viability of a unipolar world. It just doesn't work. No shame, right? No disgrace. Just doesn't work. The source described the draft text as consequential and incisive. Well, if it's going to be incisive, that's going to be highly interesting. So here's what I propose. I ask all persons of goodwill, friends of this broadcast, or anybody who can hear this, help us to have a welcome demonstration for Russian President Putin, friend of the United States, benefactor of the United States, more than our own elected officials. Our own officials swore to protect the United States. They didn't. Obama was about to start bombing. To Obama's credit, he turned away. That's important. That we note. But these lunatic Republicans, forget it. And it means that no more Republicans, no more Republican presidents, no Republican must ever be president of the United States ever again. Imagine this unstable, narcissist, megalomaniac Trump in an international crisis. We'll have more about Trump's family heritage. Trump's family heritage is summed up in one word. Pimp. Pimp. That was his grandfather, Friedrich Trump. Yeah, Herr Trump came over, right? So the Polly Adler tradition, right? The people who know that a house is not a home, that's Trump. So here's what we want to do. We're working out the details. You've got to watch my Twitter feed. You should watch it anyway, but now watch it with a special attention. Webster G. Tarpley Twitter feed about a demonstration near United Nations headquarters. We'll see where it's going to be done. All the details will be on tarpley.net. I'll make sure that we put that stuff up day by day with items, and in particular, the Twitter feed. And now I'm so happy to announce we're going great guns on Facebook, so we'll have that stuff up on Facebook as well. One important sign, if you want to start making your sign, this is a suggestion from some very fine people in Moscow and in Donetsk. They say, why don't you have a sign that just says, Putin the peacemaker? Because it's true. He did. All of these, you know, blind gnomes here in the West were salivating about how they were going to bomb Syria. Now, and again, we want to give due credit to the Obama administration and to Kerry, indeed, that we've now got the U.S.-Russian military talks, right? So that should be a coordination of how to clobber ISIS. Now, Robert Parry, the journalist that many of us got to know during Iran-Contra, when he did no doubt some good work, maybe not as radical as, say, me, but still yeoman service from Robert Parry. His sources are telling him that Obama approved in advance that Russia would send these, in reality, relatively modest military units, right? It's not an overwhelming force, but it's more than enough to deal with a bunch of ragtag, completely disorganized guerrilla fighters, mainly butchers, right? Mainly the specialty of ISIS is not fighting pitched battles against equally matched military forces. It's killing women and children, killing civilians, old men. That's their speed. But anyway, Obama approved in advance, in cahoots with Putin, I think, the idea that Russia would put these forces in there. And there's, according to Parry, it may even be that Obama encouraged Putin to do it, prodded him to do it, because the only way to stop this tragedy, this catastrophe of the refugees, is to stop the war. And that doesn't mean get rid of ISIS. After that, there's endless, Assad. It means getting rid of ISIS. Wipe out ISIS, wipe out Nusra, or neutralize them some other way, and then you'll have peace. So Parry says Obama approved and prodded Putin about the idea of this base in the Latakia area. Now, we noticed that in public, there's a dog and pony show going on, and that's even part of the report from Parry. In other words, in public, Obama is actually saying, I refuse to meet with Putin. And Putin is saying, you better meet with me. And Obama says, no, I won't. Now, could this possibly be a dog and pony show? Could this be an agreed on farce between these two leaders in order to get things done so that they can take less flack from the domestic political opponent? Certainly it's helping Obama. I think it may be helping Putin too. In other words, it's good to be seen as, you know, jabbing, punching a little bit on the eve of such a gathering. Now, these are the principal things. We'll be back in a minute with more, and we're going to have, we hope to get a report from Russia this week again. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Crisis Radio. And you'll recall, I think, people who listen to us every week, you'll remember that last week we were fortunate enough to have a report from Russia from Mr. Trifonov of the this new election monitoring agency, which or organization. It's a project of private citizens who were going to monitor the Russian elections. Now, the American media practically ignored this. If you did see anything, it was all negative. We don't need to go into the details. And there was always this gesticulating figure of Navalny, the darling of the U.S. media. So we wanted to have a representative from the open monitoring group to come on and tell us how what happened with the elections, and also what happened in terms of the monitoring system, which they are now developing. So we're so happy to be joined today by Mr. Yakov Alyoshkin. Mr. Alyoshkin is part of the election monitoring group. So we welcome him, and we just wonder, Yakov Alyoshkin, what would you say about the elections, and how did your monitoring efforts go?
Okay, thank you very much. Hello, one more time. And so about the election day on September 13th, elections took place in Russia. Campaigns of different levels were run, including head elections of subordinate entities of the federation and deputy elections of legislative body in Russian sub-entities. The elections of both levels were held almost in all entities of our country. And there is an open element of monitors who jointly with non-parliamentary political parties have implemented a trial project on monitoring the course of polling protests in four Russian regions, such as Krasnodar Krai, Kostroma, Novosibirsk, and Nizhnegorodsk regions. We would like to thank the active work of 440 monitors and specific software support. 176 messages on violations were received. Group of lawyers, experts from Ellen have managed to detect more than 48 confirmed violations during studying of monitor signals. The unique electronic system of elections monitoring made possible to trace the connection between monitors and online portal. All materials on the situation at the polls were fixed and then classified and presented to media and general public at our website. So people just just can see all the results. The website is openand.ru. And I think that's alongside work of portal, we organize hotline for media, allowing to inform about violations in the course of voting as well as getting the current information on the current situation. Unfortunately, not everybody appraised fair and great coverage of voting process. On the 13th of September, daytime, Open Alliance of Monitors portal underwent mass DDoS attack.
Huh?
The work of system was efficiently launched with reserved energy on central port address. And the majority of violations we fixed can be classified as insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
The most spread among them are more than one person entered polling booth, voter field ballot not entering a polling booth, and others. And the biggest part of detected violations, around 70%, was settled immediately. Election committee didn't prevent work of monitors and quickly reacted on complaints and appeals.
Mm-hmm.
So all the monitors, monitors work. What they did, it all made possible not only to find out violations, but it also gave a lot of useful experience and remarks to the work of online system, which will be taken into account in the perspective of further election campaigns. So I think that the main idea of our situation.
We have limited time. Now, Mr. Alyoshkin, you're not the government,
yeah,
right? You're not the government and you're not the opposition. You are an alliance of, of third parties. But now, what is your overall finding, the conclusion of your work? Is it that these elections were totally fair, mainly fair, half and half, fair, unfair, totally unfair? Where would you put these? In other words, did these elections represent a meaningful democratic exercise?
All the opposition parties approved that elections were mainly fair, I think. There is a stereotype that in Russia elections are unfair. That's just a stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
We worked together with all the monitors, with all with Open Alliance, and all our people could see the results, could see the process, and as I see, as my team sees, the elections were kind of fair.
Okay.
And if there were some violations, they were punished.
Okay. So I think that's very important, right? That's an independent view. Again, not the government, not the all-out sort of Navalny opposition, to be sure. But it's basically fair. And I think this probably compares favorably with things going on in the United States. My God, what we've had here is, of course, a scandal all around the world. So let me ask you then, what's the next step for your organization, the Open Alliance of Monitors? What will you do next?
Next we will work with the results. With the results of the elections, with people, with facts of maybe violations, if they had place. So we need to analyze our work to make next elections on the fair.
Fair. But I understand you're going to have national parliamentary elections for the State Duma next year, correct?
Yeah.
You're
going to
be in that.
Yeah. You're right.
Okay. And when is that election? When? In the springtime?
Sorry. The connections of
When will the national parliamentary elections be held? Is that, do we know the date? The date when they will be held? Kagda.
Hello?
Okay, so sometime next year, and you're going to work on that.
You asked me about the elections to the State Duma, yeah?
Yeah. When?
Yeah. The 18th of September in 2016.
Okay. That was a good friend, Yakov Alyoshkin of the Open Alliance of Monitors, and I'm sure we'll get reports about this question as we move towards those Russian elections in about a year, just about a year from right now, a year from today, as far as I can see. Thank you very much, and we'll be right back with more of World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Now, we've just dealt with the Russian elections of this past Sunday with our friend from the Open Alliance of Election Monitors. And now we would like to go to Athens, Greece, to get a report. And this will be the final pre-election report on the Greek election, which will be held now on Sunday, the 20th of September. And we fortunately joined once again by Michael Chiotinis. Michael Chiotinis in Athens, Greece, concerning, first of all, what's going on in Greece, and then we want to talk a little bit about something that we welcome very much and we're absolutely in favor of. That is, in Paris on the 12th, that is to say a week ago, we had Yanis Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece, along with Jean-Luc Mélenchon of the Parti de Gauche of France, Oscar Lafontaine of Die Linke in Germany, and Stefano Fassina, who was in the the neo-communist party, right, the PD, I guess, and they're talking about a plan B for Europe, and they're talking about a conference to be held in Paris in November. So we are highly interested, and we urge people to take part in this process, right, make sure that it's diverse, open, fair, and that it leads to an actual program. So, welcome, Michael Chiotinis. What does it look like 2 days from that election?
Hello. A lot of things to say, not much time to say it. Now, polling shows Syriza and the Conservatives neck and neck, close to a tie. I don't believe we'll see that in the election result. Syriza is going to come first by a fairly safe lead. It'll be an easy victory for Tsipras. But the question is, what kind of a government can we expect to see then? And generally, what should we be looking for? What is at stake in this election? Now, polls show ANEL, the independent Greeks, Syriza's coalition partner, under the 3% threshold that a party must reach to enter parliament. In other words, to be represented. People feel that when they vote for a party that will get less than 3%, then their vote is lost. It didn't count for anything. So mainstream media, controlled polls, they tend to underestimate parties not likable to the oligarchy and that are close to that 3% in order to drive voters away from it.
Right.
I'm sorry to become so technical, but this is important stuff. Now, in January's election, polls again showed in the independent Greeks under the 3% threshold, around 2.5%, and they actually got closer to 5%, double that. Why am I talking so much about the independent Greeks? Well, it was back in January, it was the only consistent anti-austerity party ready to clash with the European political elites. And also, it was the only culturally right-wing anti-austerity party. And I always thought it was essential to have right-wing representation of anti-austerity politics in government.
Right, right.
In order to avoid the civil war climate, you know.
Right.
That was my concern. Right now, once again, polls show that this independent Greeks party under the 3% threshold. Of course, this time around, this party also signed the third bailout deal along with Syriza and Alexis Tsipras. So this party has lost its essence, what gave them a reason to exist. So their annihilation is not impossible. But you also think they are no threat to the European establishment anymore. However, if the independent Greeks are unable to give Tsipras the seats he needs in parliament to form a government, then there comes Topotami, the river, this culturally center-left, but actually neo-fascist, neoliberal, you know, common-sense type party. And it's going to be the coalition partner, along with PASOK, the old socialists. And from Schäuble's point of view, these obedient parties are much preferable to some crazy, impulsive right-wing populists. So, if the independent Greeks indeed fail to get in parliament, we are probably going to see a government of Syriza, the socialists, and this river party, Topotami. So, a government controlled by Berlin, imposing a neo-colonial agreement and selling off the whole country. But there is an even more important point here. This election is going to consolidate the TINA doctrine, T-I-N-A. You know, there is no alternative. The old neoliberal. I think that is exactly the reason why we're having elections right now in the first place. All good-willing people of Europe will see Syriza governing according to the Troika's conditionalities, imposing harsh austerity and not being able to deal with corruption and oligarchical power, because under this deal, no law can be discussed in parliament unless it is first approved by the Troika. That's how close the supervision is. Now, apart from national sovereignty, it's now openly abolished. Seeing Syriza govern in such a way, in effect not governing, this is humiliating. And thus, it is politically catastrophic for the left in Europe. So I actually think that the European elites right now pretty much want Syriza to win. The TINA doctrine is going to triumph under a Syriza government governing in such a way. Someone can say that this could be temporary. In the coming months, there are going to be elections in Portugal, Spain, Ireland. Tsipras himself is probably hoping for something to come out of these elections. And then maybe things in Europe will start to change. The rise of Podemos in Spain, to the extent that Podemos are something positive, anyway.
Right.
Some anti-austerity political forces rising in Portugal, etc. The hypothesis is that these are signs that Europe is slowly changing for the better. Alas, I think these are small signs of resistance, indicative of the fact that Europe is actually rapidly changing for the worse. And in this context, I don't think any real positive change is possible in a reasonable amount of time that can ensure the survival of the Greek economy. The Greek society.
While we still have a couple of minutes now, we've got that other party, though, right? We've got the Popular Unity, I guess it is, right?
Yes,
what's with them? And what's with their program?
Yes. Well, I refuse to take into consideration the communists and the Nazis, because, you know, the communists are isolationists. The Nazis are, well, Nazis. I don't want to see the Weimar analogy materializing too literally. The only progressive force in Greek politics right now, real progressive, is the Popular Unity, the part of Syriza that broke off following the signing of the third bailout deal. They are for a Grexit, but not as a tool, not as an end to itself. they want social change before there can be change in Europe and political change in large scale. Varoufakis himself published an article today saying that though he doesn't completely agree with them, he's going to vote for Popular Unity. And because it has some people who worked with him in the Ministry of Finance very well, who did the only positive thing that Syriza was able to do, these things that were considered to be unilateral actions, and now under the Troika deal, they are being reversed. Polls show Popular Unity around 3 to 5%, somewhat safely in parliament, but I expect a lot more. And if anything good is going to come to Greece, it will come from that.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Always, always illuminating. So we'll be turning to you again, maybe as early as Sunday night, but certainly next week. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Topley in Washington, D.C. Now, let's look for a minute at the Federal Reserve. Boy, I dusted off my slogan, Topley for Fedhead. Topley for Fedhead. Hashtag Topley, number 4, Arabic 4, Fedhead. Looking at the unfortunate Yellen and her incompetence. Here's the story, right? There was a big brouhaha this week that the Federal Reserve was finally going to start raising interest rates. Now, what is the argument for raising interest rates? It's, of course, it's that the rentiers, the rich guys, people with masses of money, don't like the fact that their money is not multiplying the way they want it to multiply. For most of us, crushed by debt, the American people in general, loaded with consumer debt, loaded with student loan debt, and above all the credit card debt, which is a floating rate. In other words, they can raise it. Those rates have been sky high since the era of Paul Adolf Volcker under Carter and Reagan, bipartisan ripoff of the American people. We have all of these excessive interest rates, right? Usury, to be sure, going on. The argument is that the rentiers are not happy. They want more, a higher return on their money. From the average person's point of view, it just means a higher rate. If you have a floating rate mortgage still, God help you, that's going to punish you. And if you've got a credit card, they're going to feel free to rip you off even more. So the problem is that keeping the interest rates at zero is better than raising them to 0.25%. But the problem is that's also not going to get you out of the depression. In other words, the 0% rate is mainly going for hot money. It's mainly going to prop up derivatives. Remember, there are two pillars of this fake recovery which has been engineered. Quantitative easing was one side of it, and the 0% interest rates were the other side. Quantitative easing now withdrawn as of almost a year ago, increased volatility. You can see that they're frightened of the Chinese bubble economy. The Chinese bubble economy dragging down the U.S. This should never have been allowed. We should have put up defenses against that kind of thing. But with these free marketeers, it's hopeless. So what we need is to break with the idea that the central bank serves banks only. That's a ridiculous idea. The central bank has got to become a national bank. It's got to be nationalized, seized, deprivatized in whole or in part, but it's got to come down to serving the entire economy, including full employment. Now, by law, the Fed is supposed to pursue full employment as well as price stability. That's the Humphrey Hawkins Act. They simply ignore it. They're lawless. Well, again, we could use their lawlessness to force them to put out $6 trillion, $5 trillion, in 0% 100-year credit to rebuild U.S. infrastructure, 30 million new productive jobs. We've also got a matter of about 10 million entry-level Marshall Plan for the cities jobs, primarily for inner-city youth and rural America, people who otherwise might have a hard time getting into the workforce. Now, in the course of Yellen's press conference, she says that at least one member of the Federal Reserve Board, right, the Federal Open Market Committee, wants to have negative interest rates. In other words, they would charge you, the Fed would charge member banks to hold reserves. Now, if we're scraping the bottom of the barrel in this way, why not go to what we can call the Lautenbach-Voitinsky solution? This was the one thing that could have prevented Hitler from taking over. It would have been 2 billion marks at that time. Today it's going to be $5 trillion because things have gotten bigger. But in those days it would have been 2 trillion marks put out, or Reichsmarks, put out by the Reichsbank under Weimar Germany to build the autobahns, in a word, and about 1 million to 2 million jobs. That would have cut Hitler off at the knees. He never would have been able to ride this wave of despair, right, the austerity psychosis that was going around at the time. So I say to Yellen, what you're doing is an absolute poverty of ideas, an aridity, an unwillingness to think outside the box. We need, and this is now the rising tide, right, Corbyn in England, right, the Labour Party, comes into power with what? Quantitative easing for the people, and it means almost $600 billion U.S. dollar equivalent investments by the central bank in transportation, digital infrastructure, education infrastructure, and so forth. So that would be a significant stimulus for Great Britain. My own figure for Great Britain, I think, is in the area of 2 to 3 trillion. Pounds, but this is at least a step in the right direction. Same thing going on in Greece. Varoufakis and others were at least toying with the idea of seizing control of the central bank. And in Donetsk, they've been doing it, right? Boris Litvinov and others. So the whole movement, it seems to be peripheral. It seems to be isolated. But the movement of modern times is to break private banking control of the central banking system. Not to abolish them. No, no, no. Because the American people want credit creation for job creation. 30 million jobs, and that's going to be paid for by the Fed with 0% federal credit for 100 years if necessary. And that extra trillion to refinance all student loans down to 0%. And if it's $1.5 trillion, that's fine too. All student loans go down to 0% interest rates. And guess who's going to scream and squeal? Those same banquiers, right? The people who rip you off. This would be another way to fight payday loans. Let's have a 0% credit facility for families that are destitute, facing foreclosure. Some good 0% or close to 0% federal credit could come in and save the day. So this is what we're about. And this is precisely what the European Plan B, essentially, I did an outline of Plan B for Greece before that election took place. And the idea was try to get control of the central bank any way you can, and or a piece of it, and force them to put out credit for production, for infrastructure, and for these jobs. Now, speaking of these issues, let's look at the Republicans. Now, the Republican debate this week was an appalling spectacle. One of the main ideas, the only consolation I can offer anybody, is that when you see evil fighting evil, and that is what you saw, when evil fights evil, the good may benefit. That's the only thing that's kept this world going. And we saw that in action on the Republican stage. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So the Republicans, the only consolation, when evil fights evil, the good may benefit. So a certain amount of extreme evil was canceled out as these various evil forces, essentially a battle among fascist gangs. The higher the casualties on all sides, the better off the people are in the aftermath. Notice the secessionist has gone down to defeat. A secessionist scoundrel, sic semper secessionistas, secessionistis, we would say a little bit of macaroni Latin. That was Rick Perry. Remember him? In the great dawn of the Tea Party, he started talking about Texas secessionism. He's gone down the tubes, and a much deserved fate for a scoundrel and a demagogue. So will it be for some of these others. We're getting reports that Scott Walker, the union buster, the wage gouger, enemy of unions, enemy of the American people, that Scott Walker is also about to drop out, because even with all that Koch money that he's supposedly, allegedly been collecting, it just doesn't go. The guy's dull as dishwater. This is the banality of evil, as Hannah Arendt would have said. So, Carly Fiorina. Carly Fiorina worked as an advisor to the Central Intelligence Agency. Carly Fiorina, not only an advisor, but also a consultant to the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, who's hyping Carly Fiorina? A bubbling cauldron of hatred, extremely neurotic, beyond all belief. Notice, she got really upset when Trump, the great wrecking ball and Samson of this Temple of the Philistines, when he began to talk about what she did at Lucent and what she did at Hewlett-Packard. This is when she began to get the eye blink rate went up very high. So what did she do? Lucent Technologies. I'll have to tell you, this is something that hurt me very much personally, right? Lucent Technologies was in Murray Hill, New Jersey. This was the Bell Telephone Laboratories, Bell Labs. I had a chance to visit Bell Labs in the late 1950s as a child. My uncle worked there, and my Uncle Al took me there. It was a wonderful thing for him to do, fond memories of this day. He showed me the Dead Room. The Dead Room was at that time the world's largest anechoic chamber, which was a completely surrounded, baffled chamber where no sound from the outside penetrated. And you could hear your heartbeat. You could hear your own joints moving. You could hear your own digestion going on in the Dead Room. On this occasion of this visit, I saw the first touch-tone phone I'd ever seen. Up to that time, there were dial phones, but now it was a touch-tone phone, the first one which he showed me at that time. Well, Bell Labs had been one of the greatest sources of innovation and scientific discovery in the middle of the 20th century. Carly Fiorina destroyed it. She absolutely destroyed it. It's gone. From 1996 to 2006, and it went belly up, and it was bought up by a French company. The shame of this, right? The impudence of this woman to come forward. She says, we did mass layoffs. Yeah, 30,000 jobs destroyed. This is now Hewlett-Packard. But Lucent was completely destroyed. At Hewlett-Packard, Carly's job was so terrible that she was officially fired by the board of directors with prejudice. And we see her on television saying, yes, we did mass layoffs. We had to move those jobs to China. She got 5 corporate jets. She got a salary increase of 300%. She got a total of $100 million. Her golden parachute, her compensation package, was $20 million after she was fired for malfeasance and nonfeasance. And then she's got the CIA network working for her now to build her up. Who do you think is hyping her? That's a CIA old boys network. They take care of their own. Now, of course, we have got to look at the Republican Party debate from the vantage point of the destruction of the Republican Party. And that means how this thing is going to come crashing down. One thing you might note. When you have backup, some embarrassing facts don't come out. Rand Paul, in the first debate, was spared the fact that his campaign officials had been indicted for their role in the Iowa primary in the previous cycle. This time it was Carly who benefited. When we got into that question about vaccines and immunization and all this, they focused on Trump. They let Carly off the hook. Carly is the one who campaigns to try to convince parents that she shares their fears about vaccine and related stuff. So she has got tremendous protection from the CIA networks. Rand has got his southern jurisdiction, Scottish Rite, and it's a battle of networks in terms of, and I don't mean television networks, I mean Freemasonic and other networks. Now, from Politico, we find the interesting fact that the founder of the Trump clan in North America is Friedrich Trump. Trump. This guy was a pimp. We have all kinds of stuff about how he was, for example, when he came here in the 1880s, 1890s, a restaurant in Seattle, and he began essentially preying on miners. Friedrich Trump went to the red light district known as the lava beds of Seattle. He created a tiny storefront restaurant named the Poodle Dog, which had a kitchen, a bar, and private rooms for ladies, meaning prostitutes. Then he goes on to Seattle. He tries to create a restaurant, the New Arctic Restaurant and Hotel in Bennett in the Yukon, private boxes for ladies. Oh, my God. The depraved of the female sex were part of his stock in trade. And then he gets to Whitehorse in the Yukon. I guess this is Canada, I think. The Arctic restaurant, prime location, a bar, gambling facilities, and separate curtained off areas with dark velvet for the sporting ladies, gambling, liquor, and so forth. So this is from Gwenda Blair, the author of The Trumps, Three Generations That Built an Empire. So this is the story with Trump. But now we have to move on to Bernie Sanders. This has gone too far with Bernie. This week we've seen an organized attempt by the campaign of Bernie Sanders to essentially allege that he is the American version of Corbyn. Now, already Corbyn, we don't know him well enough. We can't put our hand in the fire for Corbyn. But what is certainly true is that the public statements of Corbyn have been uniformly anti-war, no bombing of Syria, no humanitarian bombing, nothing to do with overthrowing governments with British military forces. Unfortunately, with Bernie Sanders, it just doesn't work that way. The way that it works with Bernie is total support for the F-35 fighter jet boondoggle. It is reported to be a flawed aircraft. It's something like the Osprey. It's going to be kept going by people like Bernie in the Congress who have to provide those jobs. We are not very hostile here to weapon systems. It is a rough world. But Bernie Sanders is a hypocrite. And here's what I say. Go to Bernie's website, Bernie Sanders for President, right? Whatever it is, Bernie Sanders. Look under foreign policy. You will find nothing except his speech in the Senate supporting the Iran nuclear accord. That's the only foreign policy issue he has. We want to know more, Bernie. You're not going to get away with this. You're not getting a pass on foreign policy. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Systems. Yo, got to get going in a hurry to wrap up in our last segment here on the 18th of September. Remember, go to Tarpley.net, Tarpley.net, and Webster G. Tarpley Twitter feed, and me on Facebook, and keep up with the plans to have a welcome for Russian President Putin, the peacemaker, the one who, when our own government was about to go for a lunatic, catastrophic general war in the Middle East by bombing Syria 2 years ago. This is the guy who stepped up and saved your kid from being dragged into that maelstrom and vortex of insanity set up by Saudi Arabia and Turkey and John Allen, the ISIS czar. So now, Bernie Sanders, I say you better go to his website and see what he says about foreign policy. The answer being practically nothing, practically nothing. How dare he? The Democratic Party, as you see it today, such as it is, whatever it is, comes out of the crucible of the fight against the Iraq war from 2003 until the end of the decade and Obama finally ending that war. Hillary Clinton, of course, as a neocon, warmonger, Wall Street Democrat, would dispute this. But the rank and file of the Democratic Party is anti-war. If they're not that, what are they? From Vietnam to Iraq and now to Syria. The one thing he does have is the speech he gave on the Senate floor last week, and this is the only thing he's got on foreign policy, where he goes through some stuff. Yeah, he's for the Obama-Iran nuclear accord. But in the course of this, he goes through this thing saying, of course, the military option must always remain on the table, although as a last resort, period. Quote, this is unacceptable. As Putin said way back when, take that option off the table. It is antithetical to civilization. It threatens the lives and the futures of all of us. We're not interested in another general war in the Middle East. This would be the coup de grace for the United States, right? The final blow. So I want to appoint everybody to get more details. Counterpunch magazine deserves a vote of thanks, I would say, for what they're doing. They have a series of articles about Bernie as a crypto warmonger. Bernie Sanders is a warmonger, but he hides it. And again, in a party where foreign policy has loomed so large, how can you left liberal mushheads let yourself be duped by somebody like Bernie Sanders? This is impossible. He talks about the Saudi Arabians getting their hands dirty. Getting their hands dirty is a quote. Bernie, you got your wish. In Yemen, they are carrying out genocidal bombing campaigns. They've killed thousands and thousands on the ground. But the real genocide is there is no food for 6 to 7 million people in Yemen who, because of Saudi war measures, are on the verge of starvation. 6 to 7 million. This is worse than many things that have gone on in Africa and other places. So he's got this obsession that the Saudis have to run the Middle East, and he will not answer questions. I appeal to the left liberals, put Bernie on the spot. Make him answer those inconvenient questions. Force him to put some positions on foreign policy up there. And I thank David Swanson, somebody who I've disagreed with on just about everything. One of these articles is by David Swanson, who points out what Bernie is doing. And that's another article that you can find on Counterpunch. So a number of articles about his devotion to Saudi Arabia and so forth. Now, we've come to the end of another program. We got to talk about the FBI stalking. I talked to you before about the rapid growth of the Tax Wall Street Party, of the United Front Against Austerity, and of my own website, right? 130,000 notches gained in the last 3 months or so. We talked about the methods of this last week. I hope the coming week we'll be able to devote more time to it. We may have to do a kind of a supplementary broadcast. But what you need to do when you're confronted with cyber stalking and generally stalking, right? COINTELPRO 2.0, touchless torture, and so forth, is to exercise counterpunch. And that is the entire array of countermeasures that can be used to prevent illegal stalking. Illegally, the intelligence community wants to deprive you of your right to freedom of association and other human rights, many of them guaranteed not only in the U.S. Constitution, but also in the U.N. Charter, the OAS, the OSCE, and so forth. Now, I can simply say the counterpunch activities of the Tax Wall Street Party are ongoing, and also of the UFAA. There will be consequences for the people who are engaging in what they think is a free ride of slander, vilification, intimidation, and some other things, going to the point of being grotesque. There are people who have jumped onto this bandwagon who will be shocked, and they will wish that they had never gotten involved in this. These are the dupes, the fellow travelers, and so forth. They will wish they had never gotten involved in this stuff when this stuff begins to become fully shared in the public domain. In other words, the stringers will be dragged into the sulfurous pit. So for the foot soldiers and the underbosses, we say back off. A real dossier is being prepared, and it will take the breath away of some of these people. The NAG group, in effect, is going to find their work getting to be harder and harder. How appalling that here in the United States we have to deal with these things, but this seems to be the issue. Since 9/11, we've got this entire apparatus growing up. And in conclusion, I just want to say a few words. With Assange, of course, Assange, supposedly a hero, sort of got the Arab Spring going, right? The 2011 destabilizations of the Middle East. How about somebody like Snowden? Right? He's always focused on how the NSA is listening to your telephone. Well, you'd have to say with Snowden, there's clearly a dimension of the CIA doesn't like to be wiretapped by the NSA, and Snowden certainly represents that. But Snowden also represents an attempt to divert attention away from FBI stalking and towards this area of cybernetics and snooping and so forth. Remember, when they want to target you, they start with files. They start with all kinds of files that are in the federal government. They get an overview of you and a basic concept from the files, and then they use wiretaps and NSA cyber activities to get more about you, right? Keystroke for keystroke, those operations, we knew about them, but Snowden gave the code names. But then begin the operations, right, to intimidate you, to demoralize you, to drive you out of politics, to convince you that your life is a chain of failures and nothing but the slashing of your bike tires, the crank calls, the crank emails, the slanders online, the little failures, the problems, the defeats, and so forth, all being brought up. That's all based on files supplemented by wiretaps and tapping into the internet and so forth, and these other activities carried out by, what can we say, informal agents, right? The informelle Mitarbeiter. And it does come from the Stasi model. Systematic discrediting or attempts at that. We've seen some attempts that discredit the discreditors more than they discredit the targets, right? Anonymous defamation and all the rest of it. Accusations of all types, the more prurient, the better. So that's what we're dealing with. The campaign is ongoing. Stay tuned, and we'll be back next week. Watch Tarpley.net and Webster G. Tarpley Twitter for the pro-Putin activities at the UN General Assembly around the 27th or 28th of September. See you next week.